Let's do it live. Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. For December 28th, 2023, it's the Conundrums edition. We are live before a huge crowd at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. It's a crowd that's abuzz. I saw philosophers and theologians, Nobel Prize winners, MacArthur geniuses. The Dalai Lama himself is here. Oprah on one side, Thomas Alva Edison on the other. They've all come, you've all come, to hear us discuss and cogitate and contemplate and consider some of the most important questions of our time. Like, is it okay to put your trash in someone else's trash can? If you had to live in a store for the rest of your life, which store would it be? If food had feelings, would it want to be eaten or not want to be eaten? I am David Plotz of CityCast, and joining me on the Conundrum stage, on my left, from the New York Times and Yale University Law School. Did you all see the story that 80% of grades at Yale are A's? And I, for one, was not surprised, because they're being taught by Emily, so they're definitely going to get A's.
All earned.
Please give it up for the woman who does not need a billionaire benefactor to reshape American law, Emily Bazelon. And we have an absence tonight, as I've already told you guys, but listeners at home, John has been waylaid by a Hunter Biden indictment, and he was on his way to the show, he's on his way here, and he was pulled back by his CBS bosses, so he's not here. Hopefully, he might be able to join us later, we don't know yet. That is okay, yes, and well, you might boo.
Yes. Boo.
Also, Stephen Colbert was going to join us, but his appendix ruptured. I don't know what's going on over at CBS.
Something
is happening. Stephen is recuperating. When we found out a couple of days ago that Stephen couldn't join us, we thought, well, who is as funny and wise and humane as Stephen Colbert?
And beloved and willing to bail us out.
There was an obvious answer. Please welcome two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, New York Times critic at large, Wesley Morris.
Thank you. Thank you. Wait. How's Stephen doing? Do we know?
He's better. Yeah. Okay. But still off of the air.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. If he couldn't do his own show, he was not going to come here.
It seemed like a lot to ask.
I'm happy to be here. And, you know,
if you call,
I will. I always listen to this show thinking, I'm glad it's not me. Like, part of the fun of the show is really, honestly, I don't have the answers to any of these questions, so I don't know what the hell is going to happen today.
One of my own anxiety dreams is actually being asked to fill in for someone like Stephen Colbert, no notice. So I really admire the stones on you.
I'll tell you my real anxiety dreams later, and this is actually a very small, like spandex amount of anxiety on my part. So
good.
On today's Gabfest, your conundrums, profound ones, silly ones that make you really wonder about the mental health of the person who asked it.
I'm glad you said that, because having read them, I'm like, some of these, wow.
And we will have a lightning round, and we'll have a Slate Plus, which will be even more conundrums. Let's get started with one that we've all already sort of thought about a little bit, which is, Emily, is it okay to put your trash in someone else's garbage can if you don't have space in your own?
Well, okay, so there are different parts of this. So your own garbage can is full, then you would be using your neighbor's trash can, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that if your neighbor's trash can is ready on the curb and there's space in it and the garbage is getting picked up the next day, then yes, it's okay. But I also, all right, so we can talk about that. But I also have a whole set of deliberations that I do every day about dog poop and what you're allowed to do and how far you have to be from a public trash can and whether the problem with using someone's trash can for dog poop is whether they're going to see you or whether it's actually really bad. Okay, so I want to put that on the table as well.
And?
Well, I have just, so my dog has two lawns, like two blocks from my house, that she likes the best. And she has very little poops, but obviously I pick them up for sure. And so she poops, like, it's a four-block walk. It's right in the middle. The two more blocks is the public trash can. When I'm running, I carry it the whole way. But if I'm walking and it's a trash day and the trash is out and there's room, but I know it's going to get collected that morning, then I like sneak it. But
room.
I always feel...
You just said that the shits were tiny. Like,
well, I just like if it's, you know, like it's, I'm putting it, but I also want to make sure that it doesn't get left in the trash can. And I always am worried that someone's going to get mad at me.
Oh my
it's
God.
Much more about...
You're- as neurotic as I am about to go on.
I feel like I've said quite
so
enough.
Do you guys know the amazing Ben Wittes story? So Ben Wittes, great podcaster, journalist. So Ben Wittes tells a story about having dropped dog poop in someone's trash can. The person saw him do it, was furious, came out, grabbed it, threw it at him.
Oh my God.
And they sort of exchanged words. Somebody not his words, exchanged words, hostility. And his question was he the asshole or was she the asshole?
She was the asshole.
No. He's the asshole.
No.
Well, you should.
All right, wait. Why was Ben the asshole?
Because I left out a key part. He did. I forgot. He did not then pick up the dog poop that she threw back at him.
But was it like?
Wait, whoa. That's inadmissible. We're actually arguing the ethics of putting the poop in the trash in the first place.
Well, I was elaborating on it. So. The ethics.
Wait, when she threw it at him, was it still in the bag when it landed?
Yes, it was still in the bag.
Okay, well then, yeah, he should have picked it up. But he probably then like turned his heel. It's hard to have a good like exit strategy when you're also picking yeah. up.
When somebody's throwing your own dog's poop at you.
Right.
So let's just, I want to come back to this. But I also want to sort of stay with you, Emily, because I really, you know, I live in a neighborhood where I like that you started with the garbage being on the street.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
What about this scenario? What about this addendum to this question, which is that you have left your house and you've got, say, an apple that you just finished eating and you start when you close your front door and you finish it before you get to the end of the block.
And you don't eat the core.
No.
Continue on.
Do people do that?
Yes. Yeah, but okay, go on. So it's the can you dump the apple core?
Do y'all do that?
I do.
Yeah. Just checking. Okay. So that's deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Except for like the little.
You've got a real strong gut situation.
You should try it sometimes.
All right, I'll try it.
All right.
But I will just put the. I mean, I don't have public cans on my part of the street. And I, you know, I want to get rid of the core as soon as I can. I carry a paper towel with me. And so I'll put it in a neighbor's compost bin and just call it a day.
I think that's okay. I think compost bin is not like garbage. I think compost bin, people who have compost bins want more stuff in it.
No. No, in New York City, I don't know how it works in D.C., but like the city will come and take the bin. So it's for our purposes, garbage.
I
don't think that's that different, but, except it's just
so
not poop.
I guess my...
Which is different.
I just don't... Well, right. But I guess I do have... What I'm thinking as I'm doing it is, what would I say if somebody opened their front door and said, what the fuck are you doing?
And what would you say? It's just...
I'm not throwing it on the ground. And my house is all the way back there. Why can't I put it in yours? You're not going to notice. It's a tiny little apple core. What difference does it make?
I mean, if you saw someone putting garbage in your garbage can and it was out on the street, would you stop? And
no.
Nobody.
No.
I don't want to say nope. I mean, clearly
people,
there's one person.
There are people who care. And I guess the reason I think you probably shouldn't do it is that the people who care a lot.
And you never know.
And they consider they have property rights in their garbage. Actually, who here will willingly admit that they would be pissed if someone put garbage in their garbage can?
Oh, I see somebody right there.
I feel like the way you phrased it made it impossible.
I know.
Wait, so can I ask a question? Because I don't have a dog. And I've never, I mean, we can talk about the sort of humiliation of picking up dog poop twice a day. I can't bring myself to do it. But it's also why I don't let people keep their shoes on in my house.
Uh-huh.
I live in this city. No. Can't do it. Sorry. But is dog poop compostable?
I don't think so, because it smells so bad. Oh, is someone it, thinks it, that it is.
The, okay. New York City will take it. They won't. The city will not take feces.
From cats.
From
cats, but dogs, yes, apparently. That's what you're saying.
It's a hell. Oh.
All right. Well, I'm curious, but
it's been a great show.
We're just going to talk about this all.
Wait, no.
But can let's do
right,
another.
We'll keep going.
It's literally like
really
9:30.
I just think about what would happen if I got caught doing it, and I don't really have a good answer except I'm not littering.
Yeah.
Emily, what's another conundrum?
When will M&Ms no longer be produced, and why?
Go on.
So
go ahead. Sorry.
Or do you have,
no,
did you
no.
Have an answer?
I talked a lot. You talked.
So I think if you think back on things that used to be made that aren't made anymore, there things that are brands. There are brands that stop existing. So I'm sure there are things like, you know, Brill Cream still exists. I guess maybe, but nobody who's using it, and they're brands that our grandparents used. But M&Ms are so big, and they're very functional, useful candy. So the only way I can think of M&Ms not being produced is like a truly catastrophic events that basically destroy the American economy. And that so that either it's like there's no longer any cocoa butter, cocoa, whatever it is, being produced in the whole world, which is really terrible, or supply chains have completely collapsed. So I think it's probably like 23 years from now.
I think it's also the apocalypse. And imagine how many... I bet you M&Ms last forever. I think they would be with us for a very long time. I also don't like M&Ms. I don't think they're good, cheap... I really like... Oh!
Emily, you had them.
I know.
And then you lost them.
Emily, usually the crowds love Emily. I love it. I love M&Ms. They're great.
Wait, but Emily... But Emily, I've got one. I'm allergic to chocolate. So I've never even had an M&M.
Well, that's
can't
crazy.
Ooh, an allergy. Come on.
So maybe it's a world in which all children are the offspring of Wesley Morris, and everyone is descended from you, and they're all allergic to chocolate.
Then having me as a father you didn't know was your dad.
I think it'd be fine.
But wait, I want to talk about one aspect of this question that actually fascinates me, which is the marketing of M&Ms, right? I actually think the thing that should end the M&M lifespan is the sort of personification
of M&Ms.
Of the M&Ms.
Which are relatively
sexy
recent.
The M&Ms. Like they're actually doing sexy stuff in some of these ads. It's too much. Also... I think the problem with the M&M commercials is like they've made eating the M&M part of the scary thing about being an M&M is that you might get eaten. I don't know.
There's
just,
literally a conundrum. If food had feelings, would it want to be eaten or not to be eaten?
Well, right into it.
M&M's is answering the question. The Mars company, does Mars still own M&M's?
I think so.
I think so.
Yeah, let's say so.
They definitely don't want you to think that the M&M's want to be eaten, which is weird
also,
because they want people to eat the M&M.
For as long as we have famous people, we're going to have M&M's because the M&M sorting mechanism is how you know which stars are the stars they are. Right? Like, I don't want any red ones. Don't let me see a green one. I need you to take all, how many colors are there? Four? I need you to take all the colors. Well, it's probably more than four now.
Yeah.
I need you to sort these M&Ms according to my album release date, the tracks on them, the people.
You know the real story of that, though? It's
what,
an amazing story. The Van Halen.
The divification of M&Ms.
So Van Halen had this whole thing where you could not, if you went, if Van Halen was doing a show, you couldn't have a brown M&Ms. Like, they insisted there be no
Wouldn't
brown
put that past Eddie and...
M&Ms. And
Eddie and the
so
gang.
If they got to a gig and there were brown M&Ms, they were like, we're done. And they wouldn't perform. And the whole reason, it was a rider in the show, and the whole reason in the contract was that their feeling was if the people who were putting on the show hadn't read the contract, hadn't bothered to abide by it, then they couldn't trust all the sort of safety issues, all the other things that
right.
really mattered.
Eddie, so you're doing it right.
That was the reason.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Give us a conundrum, Wesley.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it okay to uninvite somebody from a birthday party?
I mean, under what circumstances is it okay to disinvite someone from anything? I feel like especially a birthday party seems mean.
You fucked my man?
Oh. Then why were you invited in the first place? You only
because I didn't know.
Out.
He just found out.
I was creeping through the phone last night, and guess what I saw? Fucking my man.
But then maybe the birthday party isn't happening at all.
I'm still partying. You can't come. It's that simple.
I have a friend who literally discovered their spouse was having an affair, looking at their phone 10 minutes before a birthday party.
isn't conversation 1B, don't do that. Don't mess with your spouse's phone. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't go in there. You don't want to know.
So, okay.
Emily.
What? No, I don't do that.
Okay.
I'm not a believer in that. I am going to, yeah. I have problems, which are more that I don't know any passwords for anything.
I think there are reasons to not have people come to your party if you find something out there. Or you just don't want to. In this time, right, maybe birthday parties should be a thing where you don't uninvite people because maybe that's the, you want to donate your gift, your birthday gift to your friends for yourself is to maybe work out some stuff at the party or something, right? As opposed to the way it once might have worked 10 minutes ago, where you find out that somebody's got some views you don't like and you just don't want them in your world on a happy night.
Can you still have fun at your party if you've had to disinvite someone?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
I think I would get
a weight's been lifted.
Man, yeah. I think I would be so torn up by that I would just feel terrible and like start spinning and it would be that I just wouldn't even, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I don't know. I find withdrawing invitations incredibly, it makes me so full of anxiety.
You're a very kind person.
You're
also, you know, pragmatic
like
and realist. But
one.
What?
Doesn't like M&Ms.
Yeah, but I'm not holding
doesn't
that against
pick up her dog poop.
Everywhere.
All right. You must pick one book from your actual bookshelf. Ask Mitchell Kosht to give to an alien species to represent humanity. What book do you pick?
I mean, do you have one?
No, not really. I want you to answer first, if possible.
Well, it's funny because the first thing that, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, what do I want an alien to know about humanity? Gibbon, I guess. That's a lot of books to be throwing at somebody. It's an obvious answer. But me, I would choose Paul Beatty's The Sellout. I don't know if anybody's read that book. It's about the U.S., so it's not particularly useful for the rest of the planet. But I mean, you're getting to know a lot about the way you can laugh at a thing that isn't working. This is one of our great American satirists, Paul Beatty, and he wrote this great book that came out, I think, 2013, 14. That's essentially a race satire of involving a lot of American entertainment history and what happens when he basically attempts to recreate it.
Why would the aliens like that? What are the aliens going to
get? Because it's funny. It's hilarious.
Would they get the humor if they were aliens?
It would, yes.
I mean, it would be a
universal
window.
Humor.
It succeeds at the thing that it's doing so that it's clear enough what the jokes are.
I think that's right.
What about you, Emily?
I mean, I have to say, and this is such a craven answer, I would pick like a poetry anthology that had a lot of different writers in it. I feel like poetry, I know. Sorry.
I love you so much.
Your form of virtue, actually my virtue signaling I'm about to is going to be even worse, so go ahead. Uh-huh. Finish.
Okay, so first of all, even though I don't know anything about poetry and I'm intimidated by it, I think that something that just is lyrical and depends on language and conveys meaning less
literally.
Wait,
so you're going to have a really good translation. You have to have a great translation.
You mean like an... but it's
translation, the alien. How are the aliens going to read it?
But that's a problem with anything.
This is sort of baked...
specific to poetry.
Okay, go ahead. Fine. Finish your point.
I don't know. I agree that the anthology part of my answer is a terrible part of the answer.
So you just want to represent all of human, the imagination and beauty.
Yeah, I get worried about choosing one. Anything that's refracted through one writer feels like choosing a particular identity to me.
Sure.
And there's so many.
I feel like mine is exactly the flip side version of yours, and it's so pedestrian, which is Studs Terkel's Working, which
Ooh.
Is all these people. Talking about how the work, how they feel about work, what they do.
It's a good one.
You learn. It's like, or Richard Scarry's What Do People Do All Day, which I'm not sure is on
No.
Yeah. I'm sure it's on my bookshelf, but it's that same
it
idea.
It might as well be. Could be.
It shows all of human activity and people's thoughts on human activity. Or parts of it, the work.
I love Studs Terkel. That's a great example. Yeah, I can't. I wish I had thought of that.
Which he's not saying about my poetry anthology.
I also like that too.
Oh, you did?
It just would never have occurred to me. That one, there's a shot.
Okay. There was a Reddit thread with the question, what would you wish on your worst enemy? Mm. With deliciously banal answers like that both sides of the pillow are warm or perpetually wet socks. So, in this spirit, what would you wish on your worst enemy? And this question comes from Patricia Gonzalez. What's the thing that irritates you the most?
I love this question. When I saw this, I was like, there's such an obvious answer. There are actually two obvious answers. One is to be next to leaf blowers all the time. And the other is sitting next to like a 75-year-old on a train who is trying to watch a video.
Okay. Mine,
for eternity.
That's good. Mine reflects, I think, both age and gender, sadly. Waiting in line, you can't lose your place in line, and desperately having to pee.
Oh, excellent.
And terrible.
A life of curdled dairy products. That's my wish. Like of all the, you know, when they say I would never wish it forever. I would never wish it on my worst enemy. I never know what that, you know, what is the thing I would wish? I think curdled dairy products. How much we've all been there. You open
sour
it,
milk.
And you're expecting it.
You didn't smell it.
Yeah.
It should be good. Yeah. And
have you already poured it in the coffee?
Oh, the whole thing. No. You've baked something with that. You think that heat can solve that problem, but oh no, it cannot.
It's your turn.
All right. This is a long one, but I think you, Emily, I think are equipped to answer it for real. Uh-oh. And then, you know, David and I can just have a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
Dear, this is from Kali Rocha. Kali Rocha, Matt. Kali Rocha and Matt. All right. Thank you for this, Kali. Dear smart and thoughtful friends, why, all caps, do realtors have to by law, at least in California, reveal that someone died in the home they are selling to future owners. No one can explain this to me with a cogent argument that doesn't graze the metaphysical, which I think of as sharing no boundary with law. Of course, a death due to crime is one thing. A natural death, however, should have no bearing on the actual value of a property unless you believe in ghosts.
That was in all caps.
Also in all caps. It's true, a conundrum that even years of dinner party solicitation can't explain. It's a true conundrum, sorry, that even years of dinner party solicitation can't explain. Under what circumstances should you take your partner or whole family? Oh, sorry. That's Matt's question. All right. Let me just get to the... It's a true conundrum that even years of dinner party solicitation can't explain. So, Emily, why?
Okay, so I think the answer to this has to do with property value and that your property value can be affected even by things that aren't real because your property value has to do with how people perceive the property.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that people will have a kind of instinctual recoiling from a house where a death took place and that's going to affect the value of the house. And so everybody has to have that information because otherwise they could argue that you hid something that could materially affect the value of the property. But it does kind of still have to do with ghosts, or at least it has to do with the association with death. I suppose you could separate just the idea of like people recoiling from death. You could say that that's different from ghosts, but I think it also does kind of have to do with ghosts.
So poltergeist, right? Like, haunted. You guys remember the film Poltergeist, not yeah. Poltergeist in general. Not set in California, I don't believe, but also sort of has this flavor of what happens when people die. What about all the other stuff that happens in a house, though, that I would actually want to know, too? If we're talking about dead stuff, let's like make a list of 10 other things I want to know.
Every happened. Really loud argument.
I mean, what about near death?
Yeah. Or I mean, like that scene in Breaking Bad where the bathtub comes through the ceiling.
Yes. That was meth made in this
death,
house?
But there was a death in
there. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah. Of course. They're dissolving the body.
Yeah. All right. What's next?
Okay. Next, I got one. How about... would you rather have a lovable fool... or a competent jerk as your coworker, asked Becca Nagorski.
Wait, what's the difference?
What do you mean, what's the difference between a lovable fool and a competent jerk? Have you ever...
You only work with people who are both, all of those things at once.
Like, as a lovable fool, you know?
Really? What are you relying them on? What are you imagining doing with them? What if they're your editor?
What are my options again? Let me just...
Lovable
I want to get the terms exactly right.
Lovable fool. Competent jerk.
I think a lovable fool. I mean, I can...
Oh, wow.
Because you know what? You know what? They're both going to give you high blood pressure, right? They're both going to be somebody you talk to your person at home about, you talk to your other coworkers about. You can't stand either person, right? I feel like, well, I don't know, now that I'm working through this.
But I think it depends. You're not building NASA rockets. You're not like building things where...
But
where,
we don't know that.
But
I'm asking.
Oh,
me, Wesley?
I think in the scenario where you're building something where lives depend on it, the lovable fool.
If you're
is
a surgeon,
idea.
This is not the right answer. Yeah. Lovable fool. You work in the emergency room. Yes. I think if you have a job or anything really depends
on it.
But what
if we don't have jobs like
we
that?
We don't have jobs like that. But we do have jobs where, like, I mean, imagine that it depends who the person is. If the person is supposed to be, okay, for us, it's like someone trying to make your writing better and also like stick up for you within the institution of the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera.
You'd rather have a jerk?
Well, the problem with the lovable fool is that the quality becomes all on you, and that makes me really nervous.
Let's go and do a quick audience poll. We're going to ask if you'd rather work with a lovable fool. Second, it'll be competent jerk, and answer by making noise. Would you rather work with a lovable fool? Yeah. Would you rather work with a competent jerk?
Woo!
A lot of emergency room physicians here.
That was a pretty even divide.
No, I think
the jerks were louder.
Can I actually?
Yeah, well, maybe that says something. A vote.
A
That was a vote.
That was, okay.
That was the vote.
That's like the best vote we can do.
I don't know if you guys noticed this. Just sorry, I'm going to take another question, which is very similar. But there was three different people who asked a question, which is a variation on this, which makes me think there is a lot of imposter syndrome going on. Which was basically, would you rather be very lucky but stupid, or very unlucky but smart? And that was Kevin McGinnis's version. There was a different version, which is, would you rather be, smart but people think you're dumb, or dumb and people think you're smart? And so a lot of people clearly are going through life thinking they're just lucky, or that they're not actually smart. Would you rather be lucky and dumb, or smart and unlucky?
It's so frustrating to feel like things are unlucky. I think I would rather be dumb and lucky. I think that's right.
Can I ask an ontological question here?
Sure.
Of course.
Do dumb people know they're dumb? Like, I don't know. I've never really thought about this, but like, I would just know I was lucky. I would know I was dumb.
Well, that's a good reason to pick this side, because you would just go through life feeling less.
I would be awful if I was smart and unlucky, because I'd be running around. I'd be Larry David.
You'd be grouchy all the time. Yeah. Yeah, we know what that's like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, the thing that's so great about dumb people, I think, is that they don't know.
Wait, which way would you be happier? You would definitely be happier.
I'd be happier lucky.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know from dumb. I'm right. Smart to me. Yeah.
Right. Perfect.
I could be dumb right now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's not your problem.
Emily.
What's my problem?
I don't know. Not that. Just take that one off your list of fears.
All right.
Okay. We see Roman ruins all over Europe. What will people 2,500 years from now see of America today? Comes from Beth Kirsch.
Beth, great question.
Just kavas. It'll just be kavas, ruined kavas. Thousands of kavas. I come from Washington, where the only monument is a kava. I love kavas. I hope that that's all that's left.
Have you guys eaten there?
So good.
My inaugural meal at one of those was fantastic. I have been chasing that meal
forever.
For 2 years. Oh. I don't even know what I got. The one I was at, the lighting was the best lighting. Anyway, let's answer the actual question. I actually would go a corporate route too. I'm thinking what I think is the Starbucks logo is just like in, you know, the cobblestones on my street that are like partially covered up by tar, you know, by paving. It'd be something like that. It'd be some corporate. It would have to be something corporate.
Okay, if it's something corporate, it's the M&M. Arches.
Oh, it's the McDonald's sign or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry. Still thinking about M&M. It's the McDonald's arches.
That's what you think it's going to be?
I don't think it's something corporate. I think it's something like Mount Rushmore or Mount Everest is just a mountain, but something like the Taj Mahal. Like, but I guess that will just be totally overgrown. That's not right either. What's a natural wonder?
But it would have to be something that is in, you know, native to like, or synonymous in some way with this place, right?
It also, maybe I'm totally wrong, and it's plastic. It's either plastic or cement.
Like a McDonald's playgrounds.
Yes, maybe it's McDonald's playgrounds forever. The slides and the balls.
I've heard people say that when they, in like 60 million years, they'll know this era existed by concrete, that concrete just is there eternally, and they'll see layers of concrete.
It'll be right.
Things made of concrete, but I don't even know what that is.
Well,
dams,
it could, yeah,
ruins
dams,
of dams.
That seems
well,
right. Or
have you guys ever? I mean, I'm sure we all live in cities. I always find that street work is so fascinating. Do you guys ever like just get mesmerized by the layers of work that has gone into keeping you as far away from the original surface as humanly possible? Like. Yeah. When I saw on my old street how many, I'm going to say centuries of work had been done, like we were about 30 feet above the original surface.
Because of just all the layers.
Yeah, just layers. I mean, 30 feet's probably an exaggeration, but it was deep. I like concrete as an answer because it seems possible.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. the battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Wesley, your turn.
This is from Brian Chechnicki. And without knowing how long you're going to live or what quality of life you will have between now and then, would you trade 3 years off the end for a guarantee of a better quality until then?
100%. Absolutely. Not even a question.
So I also feel like this isn't a conundrum, and I would say the same thing, but do you think that just reflects our age? Do you think if we were older, we would be more thoughtful and prudent about this decision, and we're being hasty because we just can't really imagine dying?
But
it's not pressing enough for us to really worry about, even though
I worry about
wrong.
It all the time.
You so. Do, really?
Sure. Have you read the question I put in here?
Yeah, that's true.
I was going to get to that.
What about you, Wesley? Would you take three miserable years?
You know, I think about
the machines, your sister taking care of you grudgingly.
It wouldn't be my sister. It would be her three kids. And so, I mean, this is sort of getting me to the, I mean, can I just read your question?
Sure.
Can I answer this question by also bringing in your question? I mean, I might start crying while I read it, which is the last thing I want to do, but, you know.
Could happen. We're warned.
Okay. This is from David Plotz.
First-time caller.
There's a history of Alzheimer's in my family. And my father is currently in a long, slow decline that's been nearly 10 years of loss for him and all around him. He's lost speech, names, control of his body. He's not unhappy or in pain, but his decline has caused huge unhappiness for those he loves. If he knew what was going to happen to him, I'm sure he would have thought to avoid it. But we live in a country that discourages suicide and assisted homicide for people who are mentally incompetent. I live in fear of the same last decade in the shadows, gradually losing myself and imposing terrible costs on those who must care for me. What can I do to plan to prevent this? How can I safeguard my loved ones? Jesus fucking Christ.
My daughter's here tonight, so she'll take notes. Take notes, honey.
I mean, Emily? We can work this out together.
I mean, I would go to great lengths to avoid this. But the problem is, and this is obviously what your question captures, there is a very short sweet spot for addressing this before you are too far gone to actually make it happen. And I think it's really hard to actually believe it's happening or to know what to do. I mean, Amy Bloom wrote a whole book about this and taking her...
It's a great book if you haven't
It's a really wonderful book. And there's a great This American Life episode. And David interviewed her too. And she went to Belgium, right? Or Switzerland.
She went
to Switzerland where it's easier to have assisted suicide. And it's really an excellent book. And one of the things I appreciated about it so much is that when they went, her husband was still joking, still present, because he had to be able to consent. And so he couldn't be past the point where he didn't understand and didn't enjoy life anymore. And there's something like... For us, culturally, at least for me, kind of breathtaking about that.
Why can't there be pre-consent? Like, why can't you pre-consent to being murdered?
Supposition, right?
I mean, that's a really good question, but that's not legal. I mean, should we be able to do that? Well, the reason we don't have assisted suicide in that way is that we worry about it being turned against people who are vulnerable.
Yes,
and
for
so
sure.
we don't, it's a slippery slope problem. We think that window of allowing for consent isn't worth the dangers that it could unleash.
I can tell you it is. Like, I can say, you know, having lived through it, it absolutely is worth it. I mean, I think I consent, there's however many hundreds of people here, to, I say in front of you, like, when I'm at the stage, well before the stage that Pa's at, have me killed. Like, find a way to do it. I consent.
Yeah.
Like, why can't you do that?
Yes, I mean, I would ask, I mean, this was in thinking about the answer to this question, or the proposition of a scenario, would be something along the lines of, why couldn't this be something that you're thinking about in the same way that you design a will?
Well, right. I mean, obviously you can have do not resuscitate clauses, but we don't.
That's different, right?
It is some, yeah, it is.
It's very different.
So, I mean, I feel the same way as you, but I do think it's important to remember that when you make it easier to kill people, then the people who end up dead may be people who are vulnerable for all kinds of other reasons. Is there so, you know, this comes up a lot in disability rights about quality of life. Who are we to judge? Is there something different about an end of life decision of someone who has been compos mentis, has not been vulnerable for disabilities through their whole life? Do we think of that as a different category, or is that still a slippery slope?
Wait, that if this is a decision you're making at the end of a long, otherwise healthy life, that it should be accepted and be given more credence somehow?
Or that we don't have the same fears. Like, we really fear making it easier to have euthanasia of disabled people, and we fear that for good reason. But if you're someone whose disability comes about only at the end of life, could we treat that as a different category morally? Is that safe?
Well, I don't understand what the problem with anticipating this as a, what is the word that's not coming to mind? But like, it's a contingency, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a possibility that I could suffer dementia. There could be a whole sort of familial chain reaction that I don't want to have to instigate in my family. Like, you know, especially in your case, David, you were living through an example of how hard this is, and you would never want to inflict that difficulty on your family. And there just has to be, I think your ability to sort of speak for yourself and advocate for what you actually like to have happen to you, written down, notarized, you know,
yep.
the whole deal. And, you know, but you can change it if you want. But
the law,
I mean,
doesn't allow. That's the thing. The law doesn't allow.
I guess the question is,
I think the law should permit that.
Right. I agree.
So you want to make more room for assisted suicide planned out in advance
homicide. I mean, people are unable to do it. I mean, that's one of the problems.
They're
unable to kill themselves.
No. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
The problem with all these conversations is the terminology, right?
Yeah. We
like,
don't
once we are talking about things that involve like an episode of like SVU, I just feel like it sounds more loaded than what it actually is. I mean, compassionate care, compassion, right? This is preemptive compassion, right? This is me as a sane, sentient person designating that I care enough for the people in my life and their finances and their time and their own families to say, hey, once I am no longer functional, once I am no longer what we can all agree will be myself, I think we have to talk about a way to make everybody's lives easier, including mine.
Right.
Probably by ending it.
Right. So you're talking about sparing other people all of the anguish and difficulty and sparing yourself, imagining yourself in that space, which is itself a compassionate instinct, right?
Yes. I mean, I think so.
I wonder if part of why this is so hard is that the human resistance to assisted suicide and euthanasia it's ancient, I think, and it came from a time where we didn't have all this medical technology, and it was easier to die. People died more quickly. Yeah. They died more brutally. Yeah. We didn't have the capacity. And so now we're at this moment, at least in our society, where it is possible. It's actually become really hard to die and in many circumstances. And then there's this disjuncture between both our laws and norms, right, and what the actual experiences are that we're wrestling with here.
I'm going to move us on.
Okay.
I'm going to move us on to a really serious question. There's a GabFest listener named Phil Goldstein who every year
Phil sends us like 40 good conundrums and we always have to do one. So this
I love conundrum built. Like, you guys are so smart. I love it.
So Phil has one this year, which is a great question, which is, what is the platonic ideal of the proper way to slice a sandwich? And does it depend on the type of sandwich?
This is why Wesley's here. He's excited.
Phil! My man!
I know there's one definite answer for sandwich on sandwich bread. There's an absolutely correct answer.
What is
the absolutely correct answer? If it's sandwich on sandwich bread, you cut
this
it on the
David Plotz.
Once
is this
on
a
the
David
diagonal.
Plotz? Sir.
You absolutely cut it once on the diagonal.
Why is that the correct answer?
Because it just creates a perfect mouthfeel. Like, you get these pointy ends that are great. You also get immediate access if you're somebody who wants that big central area where the bacon and tomato and lettuce are all gathered with a good glob of mayo. You get go right there. And it gives you all sorts of choice about how you eat it, too. You can approach it from the points. You can approach it from the center. And it's also very satisfying to hold it that way.
I got in big trouble this morning because we were at John's house and there were bagels. And I, instead of slicing the whole
on the equator. You did not cut it on
the equator. I cut it in half and then cut it in half. Oh, my God. I think that's totally fine.
Wait, did you? Wait. I've got a follow-up question. Emily, why did you do that?
Okay. So I did it first because I only wanted a quarter of the bagel. Though, of course, then I went back and had the other half. And then John...
Welcome to bagels.
Yeah, wanted... So I got... But honestly, the truth is, really what I would have done if I'd been at my own house was just tear the bread. I think...
She's a monster.
That word, audible gas.
I know. Does anyone else out there feel, please, there's got to be someone, that when you're eating a roll or any bread, or like a loaf of bread, that hunks of bread just taste better than sliced bread?
Yes. Yeah, but...
Wait. You just said a loaf of bread?
Well, I don't eat the whole loaf.
No, but it's challah, like challah.
Yeah, the
challah.
You grab
because you have
challah.
All these nice uneven surfaces. You've maximized uneven surfaces.
I think
areas.
I feel
great.
This way about any loaf.
But you can't
of fresh
do that.
Bread.
This is, again, tragedy of the common situations. You cannot do this in someone else's house, namely the Dickersons.
I didn't. Well,
who
I did.
You bought like all this beautiful lox for us.
No, I didn't grab, I didn't do this morning. I just cut it wrong.
Emily, selfishly. The reason I asked why you did it was because there is a scenario in which you didn't want to do a whole thing to the bagel, right? You maybe wanted to like dip it in some cream cheese, right? Like, I mean, I think there are
the
bagel as vehicle for other parts of the spread. I think you don't need to cut a bagel in half for that. And you don't want to bother with a utensil. You're at a friend's house. You can be mildly primitive about your bagel eating experience,
with
right?
The key is the mildly part.
Right. I don't think that if it's the three of you and Anne, is that right? I mean, you're among friends. It's fine.
It wasn't fine.
Yeah, John was really irritated.
I'm evenly split between this is ridiculous and I understand. But I want to come back to this sandwich question.
Yes.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know, one of the experiences that I have as a person who does, I was going to say this like everybody knows. I have to say something that's important, which is I don't like sandwiches. I know. Now,
is this better or worse than not liking M&M's?
There are way worse things I don't like. So, thing about a sandwich is it's a real crapshoot. Because, you know, if you're making the sandwich, you have a lot of control. If somebody else is doing it, and most of the time you get a sandwich made, you can't see it get made. And so I don't want to be micromanaging my sandwich creation. Because those people, I mean, to quote the company, some of these people really are sandwich artists. But I don't like their art all the time.
And is that because when you eat the sandwich, you can't get all the things in the bite that
I
you want?
I want everything on the sandwich in every bite.
Yeah, that's hard to
people,
pull off.
They're making 25 sandwiches. I mean, it's a hard job. Like, making sandwiches for us? This is terrible. It's the worst job ever. But people are good at it, and some of them really love it. I would just rather... I'm like... everything should kind of be a burrito, is my feeling.
I just don't take sandwich advice from a man who starts by saying, I don't really like sandwiches. So
my advice is eat a burrito.
Are there other kinds? No, we're moving on. Okay.
Let's do, you guys each do one more question, and then we're going to do a lightning round, and then we'll do our Slate Plus.
What would you do if a time-traveling Genghis Khan showed up at your front door? Assume you can understand each other's language, up to you whether to assume he has his horde with him. And I got one more. What about a time-traveling Jesus Christ?
This is a David Platt's question.
I know. I didn't even realize that before I started asking. It's a good question.
Well, I mean, first of all, what would I do? I'd be like, yo, I have some news from the future. There's a possibility Timothy Chalamet is going to play you in a movie. Let's start there.
Is that true?
Why not?
He's playing.
Willy Wonka?
I think it's more like a Jason Momoa.
That's what you hope.
Genghis Khan or Jesus Christ? Isn't Timothy Chalamet more the Jesus figure?
Timothy Chalamet would definitely do it.
Have you been to Hollywood? Can I show you 100 years of movies? They don't care what he actually looks like anyway.
Okay.
What would you do?
I would really want to interview Jesus. That seems like a great opportunity. I have a lot of questions for him.
I was focused on the Genghis Khan and his hordes part, but yes.
The hordes are a problem.
I would Barbara Walters Jesus
but
in
would
a
you
heartbeat.
Would you call the cops? Would you be like, there's a horde out here?
I mean, not unless they were like,
or would you try to interview him? Would you try to have a conversation?
I would definitely try to talk to Genghis
David Platt is out here trying to get me to say I would Karen Genghis Khan. Great. Sure.
You're the guy who called the cops on Genghis Khan.
On Genghis Khan. Yeah. It was me.
That's the one time when you're allowed to call the police, is if the horde of marauders from the whatever century is at your door. It's the only time.
Which
Don't
department
call the cops
would
on
the
Jesus. Definitely not.
Which department would do the best job dealing with
Genghis Khan?
Dealing with Genghis Khan, huh? I mean, the LAPD of the 80s, probably.
Maybe. Yeah. Listen, early 90s LAPS, that's 100%. That's who I would relocate to. I mean, hey, guys, I've got another house across the country. Knock on that door.
Wesley, give us one more.
What's the worst thing you like? Or if you prefer, what's the best thing you can't stand? This is from Chuck Tarek.
Oh, I love this question.
You go first.
All right, I'll do both. So the worst thing I like is golf, which is morally reprehensible. I love golf, and I really love watching golf on TV.
Same. Nice. Love it. Never played it in my life. I love watching. But it's hard. Wait, can I, parenthetically, is it not hard to watch it now that it really has just become more blatantly politics than it previously ever was?
Yes, and yet do I still watch it? I do.
It's just really not, I don't feel good about it. I really don't feel good about it.
The wonderful thing that I can't stand is theater. It's play. I don't like going to plays.
All theater?
All plays. I like musicals.
Says the guy who lives in D.C.
He says on a stage.
Emily?
I'm still
being honest. All right. I'm trying to be honest here.
Oh, no,
let's see you.
No, I'm going to
go ahead.
I'm about the Knicks is the worst thing I like. I mean, that's easy. And the best thing I can't stand. Oh, I think I just told you it's sandwiches.
I'm still thinking about the first one, but the best thing I don't like is listening to live jazz.
Oh, I'm with you. Yes.
Wesley's never going to speak to us again. I fall asleep every time, Wesley. I'm really sorry. Just absolutely the most soft.
Who are you watching?
It wouldn't matter. I swear to you.
If I took you to Kamasi, Washington tomorrow.
I mean, I hope I could stay asleep. I don't understand. Clearly, it's a lack. It's ignorance on my part.
I don't. No. I don't believe in that, actually. I truly do believe. The smartest thing I ever heard somebody say about watching movies came from Nicole Kidman. And
was it in that commercial that ran before all those AMC movies that she did? That because she.
I don't know what category. That was one of the saddest things I've ever seen a smart person get tricked into doing. I don't know what the deal was. She hasn't been in a movie that's been at Aquaman, I guess. She said she was in the jury at Cannes a few years ago, and she said somebody was asking her about like the grueling pace of watching all the movies in order to judge the best one for the Palme d'Or. And she said something along the lines of, you know, watching movies is really about my body rhythms and my moods. And I just don't want to be at a movie at 8 a.m. because my body doesn't want to be there. So that was the hardest thing about being on this jury. I think that there's some, and there's a lot of science about the way we respond to music, art, light. And it could just be that, like,
time of day
jazz isn't your thing. Even if you grew up in a house.
Or it could be that it's always at nighttime when I'd rather be sleeping. Or it could be that I'm old.
No.
But you don't, but you didn't
say. Did you ever like jazz?
Say, like, you don't want to listen to.
No, you know, it's pretty specific.
Folk music or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
I say that.
All right. We're going to do lightning round. Lightning round. And then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
No theater, no jazz. Okay. Got
all right. Here we go. If you could save one from death, which would you choose? A healthy 200-foot, 500-year-old tree or a small family of monkeys?
I choose the tree, but I love the small part of the question here. There's something about that that makes it harder, but I totally choose the old tree.
Wesley?
Old tree!
Old tree. Old yeah, tree. The, yeah, there's living things in the tree that you're also saving. There's families of squirrels that
tree
live in that
feels
tree.
More special.
Parenthetically, am I watching the monkeys die?
Yeah, you got to. Yeah. Unfortunately.
okay. I'm still going to go with the tree.
Okay. All right. Salt and pepper are found on almost every restaurant table. What third item should join them?
There's one answer.
Hot sauce.
Hot sauce!
Okay.
I would say chili. I'm going to say chili oil.
It's
chili
in the same
oil?
Family.
The same family.
It's same family.
Okay.
It's fancier, maybe. If you had to live in a store for the rest of your life, which store would it be?
Barney's. The old Barney's. I'd live in the ghost of Barney's for the rest of
what
my
life. What
would
you eat?
The clothes. I mean, I would eat, I mean, there's so many designers that made put stuff on the clothes. I would just eat the knit donut on a Comme des Garçons sweater. Yes.
I was saying Costco, but that's a better answer.
yeah, I was torn between the Berkeley Bowl, my favorite supermarket ever,
where
and
you sleep though at the Berkeley Bowl.
I just lie down.
In a bed of ice.
Bed of
yeah,
night.
Just yeah. Yeah, I don't
That'd
know.
Be fine, but also the hardware store. I mean, if really was forever, and if they were feeding you, you'd need all the things in the hardware store.
But who's feeding you?
I don't know.
Can I just stop? I know we're supposed to go fast here, but there's an important aspect to the wording of this question that I want to just stipulate. It does not say there's an apocalypse and the only place you, it's where do you live? Hmm. I can go outside and get a hot dog and okay. come back in and try on all the clothes. I can leave Barney's and just go back.
He has a point.
It's
we were imagining
I don't have
trapped.
To eat in the Barney's, yeah. although there is a cafe, or there was a cafe. RIP, man. But yes, you can leave the space to go out and do other stuff. You just have to come home, and that's where you live.
That in does the change in the store. The whole thing.
Well, then you don't. Probably you want to be. So
then
you
want to be
there.
Entertained.
Huh.
Listen, I will do a romantic.
Maybe you want to live in a bookstore. How's that for a virtue signaling answer?
Fair.
Well, forget it. All right. All right, final lightning round question. If you could, Inception style, replace the Roman Empire as something that men think about every day, what would you replace it with?
Beyonce's Renaissance.
That seems like a good way of
I'm
getting
I'm just
going to
make
the...
that person, make the men think about that all day.
I like that. I think that's good.
Do we believe this about the... Every time like somebody brings yes. this story up, you believe it?
We had this Roman Empire podcaster Story. On, and he claims everyone does think about the Roman Empire all the time. I think about the Roman Empire a lot.
Why?
What do you think
I also
about
watch
it?
Golf. I mean, what do you want? What do I think about? I think about how close are we like it? Is it the same? Are we at the end of a cycle of history where we too are about to, you know, we've lived this sybaritic, hedonistic life with such pleasures and such wealth and such prosperity, and yet at the door are
Was there
are
a demographic
horrors.
Breakdown of who was into thinking about the Roman Empire?
That's a really good question. Also, yeah, that just seems...
I'd like to know those numbers too. Because you know what I'm not thinking about?
Yeah.
The Roman Empire?
I'm ready to move on.
Fair.
That's our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugan. Jared Downing produced tonight as well. Katie Rayford put together this great show. Thanks to the 92nd Street Y and to the wonderful, beautiful audience here. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio Slate. For Emily Bazelon and Wesley Morris, the incredibly game Wesley Morris, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.